7th is now in session. And welcome, everybody. I'm going to go ahead and start with Senate Bill 567. Hopefully, I wasn't waiting for anyone to show up from the Senate, but we can let them talk if they need to. So, Judith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Senate Bill 567A permits a road authority to immediately take custody of a car or light truck that is abandoned, disabled, or left parked unattended on a highway in such a location that is a hazard or obstruction to traffic regardless of the time of day. We have received a no fiscal and a no revenue impact statement on this measure, and you see the unanimous Senate vote there listed on your SMS. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So I have Commissioner Sam Adams and Jonathan Mackler. You can come up. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's good to be back here. Thank you for the time. The handout that we passed to the clerk on the front of it has a story in the metro section of the Oregonian from March 2nd that happened between the time that we worked with Legislative Council and Senator Metzger to propose this legislation and today. And what it shows is a non-injury crash involving a milk tanker truck that occurred at Interstate 84 near 122nd, just on the boundary between Portland and Gresham in East Multnomah County. The milk trucker stated that he was tired and pulled his rig over to the side to take a nap and was subsequently hit by the other vehicle that you see in the picture. There are two bills that we have put before the legislature for their consideration that would improve congestion, at least in the Portland metropolitan area and potentially in other metropolitan areas on the freeway around the state without pouring a single bucket of concrete or having to buy a single load of rebar. And they have to do with clearing off non-injury accidents quicker. In your packet, you'll see we did an autopsy of a crash on a particular day that I was driving to work late. You'll see that it took 105 minutes to clear a crash that should have taken a lot less, and that the impact to the local economy was $330,000, a negative impact to the local economy, that if it had been cleared quicker in a time frame that we believe we can get to if these pieces of legislation pass, that we could save the economy $150,000. We're very grateful that the Senate Transportation and Business Committee approved this, as did the Senate. And John Mackler is going to go over a few other details, and we'll get out of your hair.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is John Mackler. I'm on the staff of the Portland Office of Transportation with Commissioner Adams. I just wanted to quickly go over the bones and the nuts and bolts of this bill for you and answer, and we can answer any questions that you have. On the back of the piece of paper that had the picture of the milk truck incident, it's just sort of a one-page fact sheet synopsis. What it really tries to get across is that vehicles that are left on the shoulder of roads cause crashes, cause congestion from the rubbernecking, and also impede the response towers and emergency vehicles responding to other crashes in the roadway. So there's several reasons why it's important for us to keep the shoulders clear. And what I think is good about this legislation, to reiterate something that Commissioner Adams said, is that it's really a zero cost. There's not an ounce of pavement that goes into the ground for us to reduce the amount of congestion and to improve the safety of the roadways. So just this very minor change, which expands the time in which we can tow vehicles under that heavy weight limit throughout the day, means that we can make sure that we keep the shoulders clear all around the clock.
So in this particular case, Sam Adams, again, just a fine point, even though it's an ODOT facility, federal facility managed by ODOT, the tow truck response is actually governed by the City of Portland. So in this particular case, this has been a great partnership between the state and local governments. We've created in the City of Portland a committee called POST, which is the Portland Operators Steering Committee for Transportation, where all the transportation operators, public and private, meet on a regular basis. with an eye to improving on our significant congestion, and these are two bills that came out of that.
Questions, anyone? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this applies to only lighter duty trucks and vehicles, does not apply to heavy vehicles. As I read the information regarding the incident case, this is someone who pulls over in a very, I mean, at 6:27 a.m. in the morning. That's rush hour, as I recall, having been in Portland twice in my lifetime at that time, and neither one of the two were voluntarily. But this person says, "I'm really tired." Pulls over during rush hour using one of the lanes, or using the refuge lane, and that sounds like to me that it's a situation where we're trying to attempt to overcome a degree of lack of judgment. And I appreciate the fact that somebody needs to get out there and get in this rig and start towing it away, but he's asleep in the front seat and he just says, "Yeah, I was tired and couldn't go any further. I can't go to the next exit." How far was the next exit?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, the legislation also sends the message that, as you see right now, just driving here from Portland, we probably saw three or four vehicles that had been abandoned for a variety of reasons. They all happen to be cars today. This sends the message that that's no longer what we desire. In terms of, and I'll have John also speak, in terms of the larger trucks, we've exempted the larger trucks because after studying the issue very carefully, we found actually that in the vast majority of the cases, it is quicker to have them repaired on site than it is to get them towed, these very large rigs. And I think a representative from the Oregon Trucking Association will speak to that. You're right, absolutely, this was an operator error. He clearly could move, and this was an operator error.
I think to clarify, if I may, make a slight correction. The incident in question, this milk truck, the milk truck was the traveling vehicle. There was
right,
a pickup that
right.
was parked. So, you know, in this case, what having this change made would allow us to have immediately identified that vehicle and, well, woken up the driver and told him to move because it was against the law, or towed them from that location, and thereby preventing the incident from occurring.
Follow-up, if I may.
Follow-up.
How do you propose to administer this so that the four cars that were on the side of the road today are moved within minutes of the time that they're pulled over and abandoned?
We're working on that very issue right now through our new post committee that involves ODOT. It involves the tow truck operators, which the city manages via franchise agreements with the city. And, you know, this particular, the other incident, there are two incidents documented in your packet. The incident from June took 105 minutes to clear. And that's what had a cost of $330,000 negatively to the economy. Our goal is to meet the state of Washington standards, which are, in minor cases, in some cases, are 15 to 20 minutes. So this gives us another tool. You will see, hopefully, coming before you, another bill that requires people to move their cars out of the travel lane if it's a non-injury accident and if their car can be moved. Right now, we have a high number of incidents that you will drive by in the opposite lane if you're lucky to get by, and you'll find the operator of the car sitting on the hood waiting for the tow truck or the police to show up because they think they have to wait for their insurance. They don't. And so the other bill that will be coming for it is out of an example out of Georgia that requires them to push it off the road or allows another operator to push it off the road if need be, and that gets the traffic moving.
Thank you.
And I represent, I'd welcome you to come back to Portland anytime.
You have a quick question?
Yeah, I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me just throw my thought out and then I guess ask you folks to respond. To me, this issue makes a lot of sense. It's common sense. The struggle I have is and thinking that this is going to disproportionately affect lower income individuals. Let me share what I'm thinking. People of greater means tend to have more reliable vehicles and therefore aren't inclined to have their vehicles on the side of the freeway. People of greater means are more inclined to have a full gas tank rather than always operating below the E. And what I'm concerned about is folks of lower incomes having difficulty with their vehicle. They pull it off the side of the freeway at 2 in the afternoon within a city, and the next thing you know, they're having to incur several hundreds of dollars to get their vehicle towed back or to get their vehicle out of tow. And I'm trying to figure out in my mind how to not punish people for an act of God or an act of pure mechanical failure to someone who's very well-intentioned, but unfortunately their vehicle broke down.
I think that's an excellent question and something we've taken into consideration. I'd like to mention a wonderful program that the Oregon Department of Transportation runs. They call it the Incident Response Team. They have a fleet of trucks that are equipped with gasoline, experts who can provide basic mechanical assistance. So for many of these cases, and it goes back to Representative Butler's question about how we find these vehicles on the side of the road, if you break down in one of these service areas, they provide you with a gallon of gas. They provide you with basic mechanical assistance to get you back on the road as quickly as possible. So that's really the first line of defense before needing to call a tow. That's a program that's very popular that ODOT provides, and it's not a fee service if they come and assist you. And that's a very cost-effective way of managing congestion and keeping traffic safe.
I think the other thing that I would emphasize in the existing legislation in that is that it has to be in a hazard or an obstruction. And so it doesn't require us. It's another tool for ODOT, for the city to exercise. If it's on a straightaway and it's well off the road and there's only so many hours in the day and only so many tows that we can get to, we probably won't get to it right away and they would have time to have some sort of responder. But the Terwilliger curves,
sure.
The intersections, those are areas that right now, under the existing law, we cannot move 24 hours a day.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Who, under this legislation, will have the ability to call the tow company? If a tow company is driving down the road and sees a car on the side of the road, are they going to be able to just stop and pick it up?
Representative, the authority is generally exercised by either the Oregon Department of Transportation or Oregon State Police or the City of Portland Police generally is what's patrolling in the city, but the authority cannot be exercised just independently by a tow truck happening.
They need to by. Just follow. They need to be
dispatched.
Dispatched.
Okay. Law enforcement official.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Right.
Thank you. Any other?
I just had one more question to add to Representative Smith. You said state police, DMV, the city police. I didn't hear sheriff in there. I'm seeing more and more sheriff patrols as I travel. Does the sheriff of Multnomah County mm-hmm. have the ability to do that as well?
Yeah, certified law enforcement official.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you. No other questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for coming. Amy Joyce.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Amy Joyce, Department of Transportation. Just handed out some short written remarks. Pretty much here to answer any questions that you might have for ODOT. So that's all I have.
Madam Chair.
I
had a question relative to what constitutes a hazard or an obstruction of traffic. Now, the obstruction of traffic, I assume, would be in a lane of traffic. What constitutes a hazard for something not in a lane of traffic?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, the statute doesn't define it. I believe it's an issue of judgment on the part of the law enforcement official or the ODOT official.
and follow up, if I may.
Follow up.
Do we know if someone at DPSST says this is a hazard and this is not a hazard?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, I'm sorry, I don't understand your question.
It's left up to the judgment of the law enforcement, was the response. The judgment of the law enforcement, these folks are trained at the Department of Professional Training Standards, DPSST, whatever that stands for today. Who teaches them what is a hazard? I can appreciate what an obstruction to traffic is, but who teaches them what a hazard is? You tell me that it isn't defined, but that they use their own judgment. They could, and we had Sam Adams say, well, if it's on straightaway and off to the side, then that's not a problem. He's not identifying that as a hazard. How do I know that an overzealous city policeman won't say, that I think is a hazard because I think it's my wife's boyfriend's car?
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, I would say that just as in any regard, we ask all of our law enforcement to make judgment calls. That's what we pay them to do and train them to make good judgments. And, of course, if that were the basis for the tow, I would think that the person being towed would have something to that would have some sort of cause of action for that. But those folks get paid, and we trust them to have good judgment, and that's the expectation.
So I'm assuming, Madam Chair, that there's a picture taken of a vehicle before it's towed that clearly demonstrates to an independent third party that this is a hazard to traffic.
Oh, I'm sorry, I thought you directed that to the Chair Beyer. Representative Butler, I'm sure that's not true.
But, I mean, after the fact, Madam Chair, after the fact, this guy comes and says, I thought it was a hazard. You know, an ugly-looking car and had a door that was painted a different color than the rest of the car. It was a hazard. You say, well, it was 6 feet off the road not even in the refuge lane. But they come along and say, well, it looked like a hazard to me. So we don't really have any picture of it. We just have a judgment call that was a hazard and a $300 tow bill.
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, I would think that folks making those judgment calls do so on the basis of factual observations, just as they do in any law enforcement activity. And those would need to be reasonable, justifiable terms that are used commonly in the law.
And Madam Chair, I guess my concern gets back to the same thing that Representative Smith said, and that is that typically them's what don't have it are the people that unfortunately end up in those terrible situations. And we've had folks come and present bills that their cars would not be towed if they were out of the refuge lane, off as far as they could possibly get. If they've run out of gas and they've made arrangements to have dad or mom come pick them up and get them a can of gas and turn around, and they come back and find out their car is gone.
Yeah. Sure. And just a response to Representative Butler, the bill does have an exemption in lines 24 to 27 on page 1, talking about if the car is parked in a designated parking area along the highway, or it's on the shoulder and has hazard lights on, raised hood, advanced warning, emergency flares, etc. So in my view, there's an attempt here to try to give as much evidence as possible to a vehicle being temporarily disabled and a driver intending to come back to that vehicle as soon as possible. And does I don't see how else we can get around a judgment call at some point. It also has a language describing the hazard in lines 10 through all the way down to 19. I'm not quite sure what else we can do with this one.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand the need for Senate Bill 567, and I'm inclined to vote yes. I guess I just want to put on the record, I'm concerned that an event for someone of lower means that this could be a tipping point for them. You know, maybe they're in school and they're trying to stay in school, and they barely have enough money to buy a pack of gum, and this event occurs, and the next thing you know, they're having to shell out $300 to $500 after all is said and done to get their vehicle. Or you have a single mom with three children, and now she's going to have to decide whether to shell out a couple hundred dollars to get her car back or to defeat her children. And so I'm concerned about that. I think I'm going to vote yes on this because I think the need outweighs the consequence, but I truly believe there's going to be unintended consequences with this, and I think it's the poor who are going to suffer.
Thank you.
Chair Meyer, if I may, and responding to Representative Smith as well, you know, I would note that the department is neutral on this bill. This isn't the department's bill. And two, you know, I think that what the current law, we have an existing law on this. The bill is an expansion to some degree, and it talks about hazards and obstructions, things that would cause the possibility of accidents, for instance. When it is not that kind of thing, there's a 24-hour notice period and such, so I just put that out.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Oh, yeah.
Amy, I want to point up in your testimony something that I really agree with. I think a tractor trailer sitting there alongside the road is a lot more dangerous than a Pinto or some little dinky thing. So I'm not sure why we're picking on little cars rather than all vehicles if we want to do this.
Chair Beyer, Representative Gilman, I'm sure that the other folks in the room may have an answer for you on that, but we did raise it in our written testimony that it's somewhat of a question for us, but we're certainly neutral on the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I see somebody just itching to get up here.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, excuse me, members of the committee. My name is Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations. This bill really is a pretty small change. What it's really doing is saying that you can tow vehicles on a freeway within a city in hours that are other than 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. and 4 p.m. to 6 p.m., which is already an existing law. So it basically what the bill is attempting to do is to say that you can tow an abandoned vehicle on a freeway within a city during non-rush hour hours. And the existing law defines what hazards are. And the existing law tells you what isn't a hazard. The concern from the trucking industry's point of view, as Commissioner Adams said, when we break down beside the road, normally it's a tire or something like that. To get a large tow truck out to tow a big truck in a freeway scenario, we've got to close down a lane. Where if we bring a service vehicle in, and again, this would have to be off to the side of the road. It would not represent a hazard. It would be what's described in subsection 3 of the existing law. And then we believe it's less disruptive and it's safer to bring out that service vehicle, change the tire, fix the truck, and let them get on their way that way. That was the idea behind the exemption. And if you think about the freeway situation and the congestion that you're dealing with, once you start towing a big truck, you're mucking up traffic. Whereas if you bring a small service vehicle in and change the tire, do that kind of thing, it's not near the problem. Now, big trucks also are under a lot of regulations, as you know, and whenever we're stopped like that, we have to put out the triangles that are reflective and all of those kinds of things to warn other motorists that, in fact, the vehicle is stopped. I think what this bill is aimed at are the passenger cars that get abandoned, truly abandoned. And we see them all over the place where the car breaks down and they don't want to fix it because it's not worth fixing, and so they just leave it and it becomes somebody else's problem.
I thought he was going to leave my family cars out of this.
And I would be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Representative Butler.
Just one question. And I, Bob, thank you for that explanation, and thank you for a well-reasoned approach in that regard relative to the trucks. Incidents of accidents and or injury and or death occurring around trucks being repaired on, or tire replaced, repair being done on the freeway. Can you give us any statistics on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, I don't have any specific numbers. I know we just had a tragic accident up in Washington. One of my members' mechanic unfortunately got out into the travel lane and didn't fare so well. But that's anecdotal information that I have. I don't have any other information. I'm not aware of any other instances where that's happened. You know, we generally don't abandon trucks on the side of the road. They're broken down. The driver stays with it, and we get it fixed, and we get it moving. So that's a little bit different situation. In terms of that being a dangerous activity, you know, whenever you are on the highway, it can be a dangerous activity. We try to do it as safely as possible, and that is the only incident that I'm aware of where something like that has happened. But I'm sure that there are others.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you make a good point, and so did Amy. Perhaps you could get that information for us. I'd be really interested in seeing that, what kind of accidents happen when semis are pulled off the freeway.
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, I would be happy to inquire and see if that information is available, whether we break it down to that extent.
Great, thank you.
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, maybe to refresh Bob's memory, perhaps you could just check regarding a UPS and an ABF truck at I've forgotten the milepost, Rye Valley, where a driver who was assisting another driver was killed just in the last 6 months.
Certainly. Sure.
Thank you. Sam Adams, if you wouldn't mind coming back up a minute, I just had a quick question. Thank you. In the Senate, when you were discussing this bill, was there any interest in maybe having you report back or a sunset or anything to find out whether this has been effective or if there would be any value at a look at this a couple years down the road?
Madam Chair, I think that given that we're expanding the hours that we have the option as defined by state statute for clearing off accidents and the relative upside to the small change, that was not part of the discussion. But as a matter of legislative record, I can tell you that we meet on a quarterly basis with all the transportation operators in my region, and this is one of the reporting items that we report on.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. I think I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2567. I'm not quite out of the House Bill mode, so. And we'll go ahead and wait, see what kind of information we get, and come back to this. I'm going to open up the public hearing on House Bill 219, Senate Bill 219.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate Bill 219 allows the Employment Department to provide information to the Department of Transportation for the purposes of collecting certain debts and delinquent taxes. It specifies that such information may include payroll data and names and addresses of employers and employees. It further specifies that the information obtained remains confidential and prohibits the department from disclosing that information to any collection agency. We have, I'll just point out your attention to the revenue and fiscal impact statements provided with the measure. It's showing that the Department of Transportation anticipates a collection of $450,000 in the 07-09 biennium and $600,000 additional dollars collected in the 09-011 biennium. The Employment Department expects minimal costs in adding another state agency to their current list of statutory agencies who now receive employment records. You'll see those same impacts reflected on the revenue statement because, in fact, those are collections, so they're reflected as revenue generated that's incoming to the state. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay. I don't have a sheet. Is there a sheet? Oh, sorry. It's in front of me. I'm not blowing on all cylinders, so... Mike Marsh, would you come up?
Madam Chair, Mike Marsh from the Department of Transportation. I appreciate the opportunity to come talk to you about Senate Bill 219. This bill would allow us to have access to the Oregon Employment Department's employee unit records. For our department, we have collections activities that occur with motor carrier, with fuels taxes, and with return checks. To give a concept of the size of collections that we deal with, we currently have accounts receivable of about $12 million. That's split between about $6.5 million for weight mile taxes, about $3.7 million for fuels taxes, and about $1.7 million on return checks. In terms of our collection rate at this time, we have about a 17% collection rate on weight mile, about 21% on fuels tax, and about 30% on return checks. In addition, when compared to private collection firms, they're averaging a collection rate of about 6.5%. So of the $12 million or so, Madam Chair, that we have outstanding in debt, about 50% of that, or $6 million, is owed by Oregon-based debtors. Therefore, they would be part of the Employment Department's records if they've had a job, applied for unemployment compensation, and related types of reports. We already have a lot of tools that are available to the Oregon Department of Transportation. Those include DMV records, credit records, internet-based types of search engines. However, the collection unit does not have access to the Employment Department's records for employing units. And this gives information about wage earners' names, the wages paid, the employer's name, contact phone number information. This is critical information, and it's kept very accurate because those employees are making sure that they keep that information available to the Employment Department for use in other records. Because of that, it's probably the most up-to-date information that's available, and therefore for someone trying to collect information or collect debts, it's critical to us. Like other agencies, we'd like to have this access, and that's the purpose of the bill. Other agencies that already have that authority include the Department of Consumer and Business Services, Department of Revenue, Economic and Community Development, Construction Contractors Board, and others. So the bottom line is that we would continue to be very strict in our use of credit and personal information. We currently comply with IRS standards. We continue to do so and would be very concerned about making sure that privacy is protected. However, this bill would give us another tool that allows us to collect debts that are owed to the Highway Fund. Madam Chair, I'm open to any questions.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good seeing you, Mike.
Thank you.
Couple of questions. There's no doubt in my mind that Senate Bill 219 is a good bill. Are the obligations that we're talking about, are they dischargeable through bankruptcy?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, the process is that we attempt to get collection from the individual that owes us. However, if they go through bankruptcy, we're in a process where we need to stand in line, in essence, as the representative knows, I know. Okay. And if we can get service through that bankruptcy process, we can get some payment back, yes.
Just but then a citizen, if they chose to list that as one of the obligations they want to have liquidated, we don't have any statutory protection, we being the state, or do we?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, when you say statutory protection, do you mean...
For example, like a student loan, you can't discharge a student loan.
No.
Can you discharge an ODOT obligation in bankruptcy?
I'm going to turn it around here. I don't believe...
Yes, you can.
You can?
It depends.
Okay. Follow-up question. On the obligations that citizens incur, do we charge them interest on their outstanding obligations?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, over a long-term period of time, there can be a charge for interest, and I'll just turn around here. Depending on what we're trying to get back within 90 days, and there isn't an interest issue. But if it goes long-term period, then there's interest that's involved.
Okay, just one last quick. Thank you, Madam Chair. And like, just so I'm clear, what you're looking at doing is being able to access employment records to find out the most current residency, the most current contact information of these folks, or are you looking at trying to garnish wages to collect?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, there's already authorities for garnishing and other activities related to that. So what this allows us to do is to locate the person and to make sure if they have an employing unit record, we know where they're working, we can find out the information about how to contact them and make sure that we're getting the payment back. So it's not because of the garnishing component.
Got it. Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other representatives?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mike, in all fairness, you and I have talked about this, and the concern I have is that we have within several state agencies the authorization to be able to collect through the Department of Revenue and other outside collection activities. How many folks do you have within the Central Services Division or within the Department of Transportation who are involved in these kinds of collection activities?
Madam Chair and Representative Butler, the focus that we're talking about here are two revenue agent collectors and a manager who manages them as well as others. And Madam Chair, if I could, the representative did ask a question earlier, and I wanted to make sure I got him an answer that relates to costs and return on investment. Those questions related to what was the collection rate for the Department of Transportation and for the Department of Revenue. It is a complex question because revenue deals with a whole smattering of different types of collections, whereas, as the representative mentioned in our conversation, there is an understanding by him and I'm sure the rest of the committee that we're focused on one particular area so that as motor carrier and other types of business are worked with on a regular basis to ensure appropriate payments by those individuals, our folks have a better understanding of that business and a better opportunity then to get collection because of the understanding of that business. So the bottom line, though, is that on average, we get 16% or 16.4% as our collection rate. Our cost is about 12.8%. So that's a comparison of our, in essence, the return and then the cost. In the case of the Department of Revenue, on average statewide, they get about a 9% return collection rate. On our work in particular, right now we do send some work to them. On that work, it's 6.25% collection rate, and their cost is about 12%. So what I want to make sure is clear there is not necessarily apples and apples to compare the work we give them now because we give them the toughest work. So that 6% I don't think is as comparable as the 9%, which is the overall average of their collections. So, Madam Chair and Representative Belner, if that answers your question.
Just in this, and I appreciate that it isn't truly, I mean, because you do your very best to collect and do your outreach first, and that's why you're here today is to ask for additional resource, not additional finance, but additional ability to access some additional records. But if your collection unit does a superior job to that of the Department of Revenue, then I'm wondering why it is that we don't fire them and hire your people.
M- Madam Chair, Representative Butler, I'll assume that's not a rhetorical question and just answer it. In terms of the focus, I think it comes down to that issue of knowing the business and process, and the fact that our folks are dealing with it with people who have regular collections on a regular basis, and they can know whether this individual is somebody who it's an anomaly not to be paying this much, and how to get back and ensure continued payment, or whether this has been a regular issue for a particular payer. And that understanding of the business as well as dealing with them on a regular basis, I think, makes it more part of the operations function and therefore more cost-effective for us. I think for an average agency who didn't have the fuels tax issues, the motor carrier issue, if it was just strictly dealing with somebody who's paying a permit or paying something else and they haven't made the payment appropriately, that's the kind of thing that I think Department of Revenue has set for that average kind of collections function. When you're dealing with a particular business that has particular issues in it, that's where we think it's better to go to a particular agency.
And the final question I had in this regard, I want to make absolutely certain, Michael, that there's none of these taxes that we're talking about are fiduciary taxes. That is, these are bum checks written by people who have at the pump or basically have sent in their weight mile tax for their particular rig, or who have sent in the fuel tax that they owe for their activities. These are not third-party activities where we've got a wholesaler or a retailer who owes you a significant amount of money, and as a result of other people's use of the road taxes and is failing to pay those. There's no fiduciary tax here, is there?
Madam Chair and Representative Butler, that's absolutely true on motor carrier and DMV. When we're talking about fuels tax situations, depending on the exact wholesaler's payment, there's a possibility that what you're talking about there could occur. But the vast majority of what we're talking about here is not.
Okay, and the reason I ask that, and that goes back to Representative Smith's question, I think that when they are collecting fuels tax on behalf of a third party, they have a fiduciary obligation, and I don't know if that's dischargeable in bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. But I'm concerned about the amount of that, and there's less than $1 million as I look at it, $856,000 total of fuels taxes that are involved of the millions of dollars that you're out there looking for, Mike. And
that's correct.
My concern is that if you've got some bad actors that are authorized by the department to collect these taxes, maybe they have some obligation to do a little bit better job giving them that authority before they start to collect that tax, that you have a little bit more oversight in regard before you let them collect that tax from a third party and then not pay you.
Madam Chair and Representative Butler, there are other factors to consider, even in our own process, as we mentioned bankruptcy earlier, bankruptcy as well as transfer to Department of Revenue, as well as transfer to a private collection agency. So there are several pieces of how we work this, so I hear what you're saying.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one last question. Do we charge for the cost of collection?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, we don't charge for the cost of collection. We charge in the overall cost of the program, in that we have an expenditure limitation within the budget, and that component becomes part of the cost of the overall Department of Transportation. So the taxpayers end up paying. The point of having these people employed, though, is that there's a return on the investment for each one.
We're not going to solve it today, but I would hope maybe next session you folks would look at bringing a bill forward that would allow the Department of Transportation to pass on the cost of collection. When someone incurs an obligation and they don't honor that obligation, and every taxpayer in the state of Oregon has to foot the bill to collect on that, to me that doesn't seem fair. And every other lender out there passes on the cost of collection. To me, it seems like that's something you should have a tool to have in your toolbox.
It's going to be less than 36%.
That's right.
We'll keep that in mind, Madam Chair.
No other questions? Thank you. Len Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lynn Nelson with the Employment Department. We're neutral on this bill.
Okay. Any questions? Any questions, anybody? Questions, concerns?
Madam Chair, I expressed this earlier in a different committee, and Representative Reed was there. The kinds of records that you have on people are extremely confidential and extremely sensitive.
Correct.
And I would want some assurance from the department that if you are going to work hand in glove with the Department of Transportation, that we have some assurance from yourself and from the IT folks and from the other folks who have the ability to transmit this information back and forth. You have penalties in place right now today where your staff, if they abuse or misuse or divulge information about the information that's available to you about folks that are employees, there are penalties in place. Is that correct?
We have an audit process in place where we require state agencies to submit an annual report to us. And those annual reports come into our internal auditor. Our internal auditor will have periodic checks on the systems. And indeed, that will be revoked if we find that they are abusing any confidentiality matters.
Let me just follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. Lynn, if someone in your shop today abused and violated the information that was available to them, did they just lose their job, or are there other penalties in place, including monetary penalties for the release of information, which is treated to be confidential tax information?
Okay, sorry, I misunderstood your question.
Okay.
If the employee releases, gives, any kind of, I'm sorry, if the employee does anything outside of their job and releases confidential information, yes, they will be dismissed from their job. But on the other end, if we find that the state agency is providing, information they shouldn't be, it will be revoked for their use.
Follow up, if I may. So the only penalty is just loss of. So if you have an employee who has access to how much everyone is earning in any company, and that information is all provided month by month and quarter by quarter, and they happen to go out and release that information and abuse it, the maximum penalty right now is loss of their job.
Well, I'm misunderstanding. You're talking about an employee of the company state agency?
I'm talking about within the Department of Employment, are there fines that are imposed for the release of information relative to an employee's vital personal information?
At this time, there is not.
And so, Madam Chair, just as a follow-up, the only thing that we're talking about here is that if someone within the department releases information and they have, I'm going to guess, information on an as-needs-to-know basis only, you're not releasing all of your records.
Correct.
The only penalty that there would be against the Department of Transportation would just be to say, from this point forward, you will no longer have access to it. Does the bill say that?
No, it does. It does not clearly say that, no. I mean, it doesn't say exactly what will happen if, they're providing confidential information to places they're not supposed to be. So, no.
Come on now.
Madam Chair, I just want to, Mike Marsh and ODOT, support the idea that if an ODOT employee did, as Representative Butler is discussing, they would be fired on our end. Plus, we would look to the maximum extent of the law. We have gone to other cases where there has been something that has occurred, and we have gotten additional payment made on the basis of a cause of action that caused a person harm, and have gone after them to retrieve that those funds and on that basis. So we worked with the Secretary of State and the State Police to seek those. So we're very aggressive on getting that. You may have read about the case in Coos Bay recently where we did just that. So I want to make sure that was clear.
Thank you. And that does assure me that the department does intend to take a greater level of care and concern about the information that they were seeking and requesting from the Department of Employment. And I would hope the Department of Employment would have a very strict set of rules and guidelines under which they would be releasing only as a needs-to-know basis on individual items that are brought forward, and that they will coordinate those between the two departments. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 219 and open a work session on Senate Bill 219.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 219 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves Senate Bill 219 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any comments?
I've got a question, Madam Chair. Do we know that there exists in the statutes presently sufficient and I think that it probably does, but I just want to make certain that it's on the record that there are sufficient safeguards of information that might be transmitted back and forth so that the department has the Department of Transportation has a fail-safe system that they've examined in the past, because now they are gaining information which truly has been very well protected and held very confidential in the past. I just need that assurance, and I think Mike Marsh has given us that assurance on the part of the agency.
Thank you. Do you need it repeated, or you're okay with it? Okay. Those of the opinion, Senate Bill 219 should be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We'll vote aye. Those opposed, no. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Buckley.
Aye.
Representative Butler.
Yes.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Chair Byers.
Aye. The motion carries. Do I have a carrier? Do we need a carrier or consent? I need a carrier.
Madam Chair, this information or this issue came up in an earlier hearing, and I just feel like it would be appropriate for someone on the floor to indicate that the department, and I'll be happy to carry it. If the department will come back, Department of Transportation will come back to me with their assurance and for the record that they have worked through the details as much as they can with the Department of Employment, so that we can assure members of the House that the information will be vouchsafe. And that's this is 35 years of practicing public accounting, saying this information is absolutely confidential. And now we're going to transmit it back and forth between agencies, and I would like to see it maintained with that same degree of high confidentiality. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Butler. So at this time, Representative Butler is going to be a carrier. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 219 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 222.
Madam Chair, members, Senate Bill 222A authorizes the Department of Transportation to enter into agreements with other jurisdictions for registration, collection of fees, and insurance verification for trucks operating interstate. It deletes a requirement that trucks operating in Oregon but based elsewhere file proof of liability insurance with Oregon. And it deletes a requirement that trucks carry weight receipts or passes on the vehicle. It would declare an emergency effective upon passage. We have a no revenue impact. I will point your attention to the fiscal impact that comes with the Anne Gross version of the bill. You're seeing $1 million in each biennium of total other funds expected as expenditures, followed by, you'll see a revenue statement. The department expects to collect $6 million per biennium for the Gross Unified Carrier Registration Program, $5 million of which would be remitted to that depository, with the remaining $1 million each in other funds revenues covering those expenses. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Greg Delpani, ODOT's administrator for its Motor Carrier Transportation Division. I'm here this afternoon to speak to you about Senate Bill 222, the A. and Gross version. You have my written testimony. I'll just give you a quick thumbnail sketch of what's transpiring. The recent Federal Highway Reauthorization Bill, known as Safety Lou, preempted several existing Oregon revised statutes, and it also created a new national base state agreement known as the Unified Carrier Registration System. Senate Bill 222, simply stated, conforms Oregon revised statutes to new federal law by deleting a requirement that interstate motor carriers must register their federal operating authority before operating in Oregon. It deletes a requirement that interstate motor carriers must file an insurance filing with the state of Oregon before operating in Oregon. It deletes a requirement that Oregon motor carriers must carry in the cab of their trucks a weight mile tax paper credential known as an Oregon weight receipt and tax identifier. In addition to conforming Oregon revised statutes to federal law by taking those actions, Senate Bill 222 also gives the department authority to participate in the new multi-jurisdictional agreement known as the UCR, or Uniform Carrier Registration Act. This is a base state agreement through which the federal government intends to prepare or create a single database of all interstate motor carriers, brokers, freight forwarders, and leasing companies. Once the program is underway, the participating states will collect fees from motor carriers based within the state and based outside of the state, and they will forward those fees to a national repository. And states such as Oregon that are participating in this system for the first time and never having participated in a predecessor system will receive a minimum of $500,000 per year of the receipts that are collected. The purpose for that is to pay for the origination of the program, the operation of the program, and any costs of administration. That's my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Del Ponte, so what would happen if we don't pass this bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, for the portions of law that have been preempted, I and my staff will not be able to enforce those provisions. If we were to continue to enforce those provisions, write citations, file monetary complaints, et cetera, a motor carrier would have a defense of saying to the Court of Appropriate Jurisdiction, the state may not take this action. Federal law has preempted them. So they would have an affirmative defense. We would have Oregon revised statutes that are out of compliance, and that could precipitate complaint and further action from the federal government. On the piece that is not conforming Oregon revised statutes to federal regulations, that is entirely voluntary. Oregon does not have to join the UCR. Our reasoning in recommending that we do is that the requirement to register and pay fees to UCR will accrue to every Oregon-based motor carrier. And our belief, and in consultation with the Oregon trucking industry representatives, we felt that it was appropriate for, if Oregon-based businesses are going to be required to meet a federal requirement, it's appropriate that they look to their state government for the means to do so. If we choose not to join UCR, all Oregon-based motor carriers would be forced to seek another safe harbor. They'd have to approach another state of their choice and make some other alternate arrangement to join UCR and remit and pay fees.
Madam Chair, maybe more than a question. It doesn't seem like this is doing Oregon any favors, does it? It seems like we had better laws protecting the state than we do under federal regulations.
If I may, Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, I think that's an astute observation. In particular, with regard to the requirement that we're no longer allowed to require interstate motor carriers to file insurance, mm-hmm. Instead, we are to look, the thought process was interstate motor carriers shouldn't have to submit to duplicative requirements. In other words, file the insurance with the federal government and then turn around and file it with any other state that wishes it. However, in Oregon, to this date, I can tell you that I am aware of the insurance on file for every motor carrier that operates in this state. I do not think that every other state can make such a claim. And if we are to rely upon the federal government's filing, we know that the federal government does not require a filing for every category of motor carrier. There is no doubt that Oregon's repository of insurance information was superior to that which we will have as a substitute in the federal system. So your observation is correct in that regard. With regard to the some of the others, I think they're of less significance. Your point is well taken, but the Oregon weight receipt and tax identifier, for example, it's a piece of paper that's carried in the cab of the truck. But quite honestly, our field operations are more or less automated, and they're dependent on computers. We type in the license plate on the truck when it presents itself, and we know if it's registered in our weight mile tax system or not without ever asking for the paper credential. So while it strikes me as unfair that Oregon's been singled out, since we are unique in having the weight mile tax, we're not allowed to have our tax credential. Fuel tax credentials are allowed to be required. It really is not injurious to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
I'm looking at page 2, Greg, on the proposed fees that are to be charged, and as I see an operator of a tractor trailer get two rigs, $19.50 apiece for two, and if they've got 100, the average is $8.06 for the 100 rigs. If they've got 1,000, it's $3.84 per rig for 1,000 rigs, but when they go to 1,001, then they're up to $37.50 per rig. Is that, it looks like there's a lot of cliffs and valleys there.
Excuse me. Madam Chair, Representative Butler, the fee has been calculated based upon the estimated number of interstate motor carriers, freight forwarders, brokers, leasing companies, et cetera, to approximate a known dollar amount. Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration has appointed a national committee of state and industry representatives to recommend this fee schedule as well as work towards implementation of the UCR. They are replacing fees that were generated heretofore under the single state registration system, which the same federal legislation safety lieu eliminated. So they have a fixed number that they're trying to hit, and they're just doing arithmetic by whatever means they've done. And they believe that based on the known population of the aforementioned entities, that these fees will collect the amount in question. I don't think there's any rhyme or reason to it beyond arithmetic.
Yeah, it really is arithmetic, because if I was at 100 rigs, then I would have an average of $8.06. But if I add one tractor trailer or one additional rig, then it goes from $8.06 for those 100 units that I've got to a total of $38.40 for the 101 for each of the 101.
Madam Chair.
In that regard, it may be cheaper for me. Not that when I'm saying, do I add another tractor trailer to go off and help deliver hay to Southern Oregon? I say, nah, I don't want to do that. It's going to cost me $1,000 or $2,000. It's going to cost me difference between $806 and $3,840, and that's $3,000 more in fees. And I won't do it.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, your observation is correct, and you're not the first one to mention it to me. I've heard motor carriers make the same observation.
Well, I appreciate that. I appreciate the fact that he's probably had a lot of information about it, and there's probably lots of misinformation out there, too. All this time, I thought Safety Lou was guarding porta-potties on ODOT work sites.
So.
Any other questions here? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Would Mr. Russell like to add anything, or is just keeping an eye on things?
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations. Representative Tomei, your observation is absolutely correct when it comes to insurance filings. The system we have today in Oregon is far superior to the system in all other states. Oregon is the only state today that requires an insurance filing. Interstate carriers are required to file with the federal government. The federal government is today not doing a very good job of running that program, and it's not working very well. So that is a real downside of that piece of legislation. The UCR piece is sort of a frustration. This is an example of government becoming dependent on revenue, and industry keep trying to find a less expensive way to pay the revenue. This goes back years and years when we used to have what was called the bingo stamp program, and some of you that have been around trucks a long time ago remember that. We called it lick it and stick 'em, because you'd have to put these stamps on this card to indicate which states you'd paid the fees to. And those fees were used to enforce the interstate regulations. Those interstate regulations were eliminated in 1980, and then states were preempted in 1995. So the regulations no longer existed. So then we went to single state, which was a much less expensive way to pay the same fees, even though there was no purpose any longer in paying the fees, because then we just got a Xerox copy of a credential that we could put in every truck. We didn't have to lick and stick all those darn stamps and make sure that they were in the right truck. And this is yet another iteration of that. We're still trying to pay the money that we paid when states were enforcing the interstate regulations that no longer exist, but the states have become dependent on the revenues. Oregon was not one of those states. There were 38 states that were part of that program. Oregon never did participate. And at our urging, ODOT agreed to put that in the bill because we get such outstanding service from ODOT that we preferred to pay those fees here rather than pay them in another state. So that's really what was going on there. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Yes, sir. Well, committee. That's it, unless I can drag a couple more people out of the audience. And I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 222. Do we want to go into a work session, or do we want to mull this one for a while?
I want to be angry at the federal government for a week.
Then bring it back and do our work.
We could just move it. Except for that, we could move it. I mean, it's
just do it.
Open a work session on Senate Bill 222.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 222 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Smith moves Senate Bill 222 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Question on that?
Senate Bill 222 engrossed. Discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, there's both revenue impact as well as expenditure impact, and it's fairly substantial, and I realize that it's a flow-through. Don't we need disbursement authority and expenditure authority granted for this particular bill?
Thank you. A very good question, one we've been talking about here. Judith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Butler, the Chair astutely asked that question before the committee started, then I went down to Legislative Fiscal to get their advice. I did speak with Susan Jordan, who was a supervisor reviewing this statement, and she indicated that it would be more typical for the department to come to E-Board to ask for that expenditure authority should they end up needing it. And so she did not feel that it needed to go to Ways and Means. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Judith. Any other questions?
So this goes to E-Board as opposed to going through the full legislative process is what we're being told. Because it looks like it's a foregone conclusion that we will be collecting the money, and if we are collecting the money, we are going to have disbursement authority. And I guess I'm a little bit surprised that if we know that it's there, usually the emergency board handles those things that we didn't know about during session. So, but by the same token, I'm going to say that Susie Jordan is certified smart when it comes to these kinds of things. If she wants to handle that in the emergency board process, I'd say that's fine too. I would have thought that we would have done it in a regular legislative while our committees are in session, and I would defer to Representative Smith because he's just recently chaired that committee.
Madam Chair, if I might comment, all things being equal, I would entirely agree with Representative Butler. What I think that I was probably less than clear about in sharing with you in my testimony, I hinted at it, the ongoing work to actually create the UCR and the work body that has currently been constituted is moving along quite tediously. They are well beyond their timeline. It is questionable whether the work will be accomplished this year or perhaps even next year. There's even some undercurrents of discussion that they might not be able to pull it off. And so in my own mind, it had occurred to me that an appropriate way to approach this might be to give us the authority to join the UCR if and when it does come to pass. And at that point in time, and I'm comfortable in saying it will not be in the near term, we would come back to the Legislative Assembly and probably through an e-board. I agree I need to have expenditure authority and limitation to spend the $500,000. But that was my thinking.
Madam Chair, my inclination would be to send a message to say, hey, the Oregon House didn't even approve this legislation to join the UCR. That's how much they felt like that it was really valuable to Oregon's trucking industry. But I then appreciate the fact that that then leaves our industry hanging out where they've got to go deal with Idaho, Washington, or California to run on the necessary authority so that there is a uniform insurance arrangement. So I appreciate where you're coming from. We're between the devil and the deep blue sea, and it's working through the details. But I appreciate, Greg, if you tell me the sun's going to rise in the west in the morning, I'll set up my lawn chair to witness it.
Wait on that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other discussion?
Madam Chair, I'm going to vote no just because I'm feeling cranky. This really makes me mad when the federal government does this to us. It puts us in a position where we're going to be worse off than we were before. I mean, it's sort of like the Federal ID Act. You know, we're stuck with dealing with these, and it's not going to make any difference, so I'll be voting no.
Thank you, Representative Tomei.
And Madam Chair, I'll vote with Representative Tomei as long as we can get this out of committee.
Why don't you vote last, Representative?
Those are the opinions. Senate Bill 222A engrossed should be reported to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. We'll vote those aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Buckley.
Aye.
Representative Butler.
No.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
No.
Chair Byer.
Aye. The motion carries. Now, which of you two wants to carry?
The co-carry action there.
I will go ahead and volunteer to carry the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
No, I'll let you.
And Greg's going to give you the talking points about how excited they are about this.
That's right.
Be prepared for some questions.
The work session on Senate Bill 222 is closed, and the committee is over. And thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.